The broadcast of the reading of the Richmond Times-Dispatch on the Virginia Voice is made possible due to the generous support of the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Welcome to the reading of the Thursday, April 18th Richmond Times-Dispatch. I'm Alex Childress for the Virginia Voice. We'll have about 25 minutes of front page and local news, followed by about 25 minutes of news from the nation and world. After that, a half hour of editorials, columnists, and letters to the editor from the opinions pages, as well as other news as time allows. Our final half hour, we will begin with the obituaries, and then whatever else we have time for. But before all that, the 3-day Richmond area forecast. Today, a high of 84 and an overnight low of 50, mostly sunny and warmer. Tomorrow, a high of 71 and an overnight low of 56, cooler with an evening shower. Finally on Saturday, a high of 68 and an overnight low of 47, and rather cloudy. Your readers for today are Sandy Mayer and Steve Hovjacki.
Our front page article today leads off with Virginia officials to seek fresh start on a budget. Leaders declare truce and will return for a special session. This is written by Michael Martz and David Ress of the Times-Dispatch. Governor Glenn Youngkin and General Assembly leaders are starting with a clean slate in an effort to reach a new state budget, avoid a potential government shutdown, and buy time to determine how much new revenue they will have to spend over the next 2 years. Youngkin and assembly leaders of both parties gathered in the state capitol around Howden's statue of George Washington on Wednesday afternoon to declare a working truce in their ongoing battle over taxes and spending. They have been at odds over the $188 billion two-year budget that the Democratic-controlled legislature adopted last month, and the Republican governor tried unsuccessfully to amend this week. An hour earlier, the House of Delegates voted unanimously to set aside the record 242 amendments the governor had proposed to the budget bills the Assembly had adopted on March 9th for the fiscal year that ends on June 30, and for the two fiscal years that start July 1st. The House delayed any action on the bills until a special legislative session that Youngkin said he and the Assembly agreed to call on May 13th for a vote on May 15th. The dates are meant to allow time for negotiation and potential compromise on a $1 billion sales tax expansion that Youngkin had promised to block. "We are committed to start working," the governor told news media in the Capitol Rotunda shortly after the meeting with legislative leaders at his office in the building. After an often rancorous 60-day session ended with Youngkin thwarted in his top priorities, legislative leaders visited the governor in the House Appropriations Committee conference room on Tuesday afternoon to begin talking about their differences. They met again on Wednesday morning, hours before the Assembly reconvened to consider the governor's proposed amendments to the budget and more than 150 other bills, as well as a record 153 legislative vetoes. The House sustained all of the governor's vetoes. Democrats hold a 21-19 edge in the Senate and a 51-49 edge in the House, which meant it was unlikely lawmakers would muster the two-thirds votes to override a veto. As for the budget, the House, the Senate, and the governor all got in a room together and we had a conversation, said House Appropriations Chair Luke Torian Wednesday after the House set aside the governor's proposed amendments to the current budget and the next two-year spending plan. Everyone came to the table because everybody realizes the budget is essential to the Commonwealth and to the localities. Lawmakers and Youngkin will now work to fashion a budget agreement in order to prevent a government shutdown when the fiscal year ends on June 30. Can I sing Kumbaya? Speaker Don Scott, Democrat from Portsmouth, told the Richmond Times-Dispatch. The turning point came over lunch on Monday in a conversation between Senate Finance Chair Louise Lucas, Democrat Portsmouth, and Senate Minority Leader Ryan McDougall, Republican from Hanover, who have been calling for tempers to cool and for Youngkin and Assembly leaders to start having face-to-face conversations. Youngkin met Lucas later that day, setting the stage for meetings on Tuesday and Wednesday in Torian's conference room. Lucas, who has proved a formidable political adversary for the Republican governor, said the thing that changed was a lot of collaboration. Nothing helps the process more than bringing people around the table. Youngkin said the political tone changed because we spent time together. Lucas added a lot of time together. The shift in political mood was evident in the 100-0 House vote that the governor's budget amendments did not meet the constitutional standard of being specific and severable from the entire $188 billion two-year spending plan. After that, the House voted to pass by, for the day, a vote on the budget, effectively putting the budget bill on ice. House Minority Leader Todd Gilbert, a Republican from Shenandoah, urged his fellow Republicans to kill the governor's amendments. We have to find a way to dispatch this bill so that we can do the things that need to be done in order to reach an agreement on the budget. The key to reaching an agreement does not cross Youngkin's red line of not increasing taxes, depends on how much revenue Virginia collects in the fiscal year's final quarter, which began on April 1st. State income tax payments are due on May 1st, so the governor and assembly budget leaders are waiting for a clearer picture of how much new revenue will be available when the fiscal year ends on June 30th. Youngkin reported on Tuesday afternoon that the revenues were running almost $400 million ahead of forecast in the first 9 months of the fiscal year, and potentially $1 billion depending on highly unpredictable estimated and final income tax payments by sole proprietors and investors whose taxes are not withheld from their paychecks. The governor said he had met with assembly budget leaders to talk about the increasingly optimistic revenue outlook based on a 5% increase in revenues in March compared with the same last year and a 6.2% gain in the first 9 months of the fiscal year. With Virginia reliant on tax collections in the final 3 months of the fiscal year to pay for its current budget obligations, Youngkin said, there is still risk there, and we recognize that. Gilbert, a former House Speaker before Democrats regained a majority in the legislative elections last fall, said, the detente that we hope we have made, that may be looming, is coming even though there has been posturing on both sides. An agreement will not happen in a day. We understand there are legislative priorities on the other side of the table. The governor does not want to reach further into Virginia's pockets, but there may be ways to accomplish both, he said. Some bitterness lingered over Youngkin's unprecedented attempt to rewrite the budget and veto Democratic legislative priorities. Delegate Sam Rasool, Democrat from Roanoke, addressing his remarks to Scott, as Speaker of the House, said, this is not the way we do things, Mr. Speaker, if we are really trying to find common ground. Torian, standing next to Youngkin, made clear that the House has not yielded to the governor on anything in the pending budgets. That includes the legislature's proposed expansion of the state sales tax to digital services. The governor initially made that proposal as part of his package to cut taxes by $1 billion. Then he vetoed the provision when Democrat leaders included it without offsetting tax cuts. Nothing is off the table, the budget chairman said. everything will be up for discussion and determination. However, Torian was optimistic in an interview immediately after the budget vote. "We're pretty close," he said. "There are some things we have to iron out, but we are close." Delegate Nick Freitas, a Republican from Culpeper, said it will not be easy, but lawmakers are determined. "We have a very, very difficult budget compromise going forward," he said. "We have to get some sort of budget." This lead piece in today's newspaper was Virginia officials seek to do a fresh start on the budget. It is written by Michael Martz and David Ress of the Times-Dispatch.
Thanks, Steve. We're continuing on page 12 with an article titled "Cutting Through the Stigma, Black Barbers Bring Mental Health Care to the Styling Chair." This was written by Daryl Smith of the Sacramento Bee. Brothers Marichal and Rodney Brown follow in their father's footsteps at their Heritage, which is spelled H-A-I-R-I-T-A-G-E, barbershop in California's capital city of Sacramento. Early D. Brown was a certified master barber in their Bay Area hometown who counted San Francisco Giants players among his clientele. He even named son Marichal for family hero and Giants Hall of Famer pitcher Juan Marichal. But their father's shop provided much more than a haircut and a shave. It was also a sanctuary, with Early known as a trusted ear. His shop featured a back room where he would sit with customers who wanted a more private conversation. "We, as black men, we're taught not to show emotions," Marichal said, "but as black men, we can talk to others who understand." Today, the Browns and their shop are part of a growing national network of black barbers and stylists who have become frontline mental health advocates in their communities as member of the Confess Project of America Barber Coalition. The project capitalizes on the centrality of the barbershop in the lives of black men and youth by becoming a conduit for care. The project is the brainchild of Lorenzo Lewis, the Atlanta-based behavioral health professional who founded Confess in 2016. The project's vision: "I am more than a pair of clippers. I am improving my community through the barber chair, one client at a time." The Confess project to date has trained more than 4,000 barbers and stylists in 54 cities across the country since its inception. Barbers must be licensed, have access to social media, and be willing to receive mental health training to become part of the coalition. Cultural biases have caused so many problems: misdiagnosis, in treatment, lack of understanding. "It's important to advocate for ourselves," said Darnell Rice, one of the trainers who joined Lewis in Sacramento last month on the first stop of a multi-city tour for the Confess Project's Beyond the Shop program. The program extends Confess's mission by training and helping black hair care and other workers to help be mental health advocates for black men, boys, and their families, connecting them with mental health services and helping to close the gap of mental health access and care. In Sacramento, Confess barbers and stylists work with Turning Point community programs. "We see people at their highest and at their lowest. They reveal everything that goes on with them," Marichal said. Since joining, he said, he's helped customers with referrals to clinicians and has helped more than a dozen in the program. The August California Healthcare Foundation study, Listening to Black Californians with Mental Health Conditions, showed how personal mental health struggles are for many black Americans. Nearly one in four reported a mental health condition. 3 in 10 black women who responded reported mental health conditions, while about 20% of black men reported a mental health condition. But many more black men fail to report their symptoms, reticent to talk about what they're going through in their lives, even as discussing mental health is shedding its taboo in the black community. Even when blacks seek out care, many leave the doctor feeling ignored, disrespected, disbelieved, or blamed for what they were experiencing, the study showed. 4 in 10 with mental health conditions say they avoided care because they felt they could not be treated fairly or with respect and devised strategies to lessen poor treatment. More troubling, suicide has become the third leading cause of death for black male teens and young adults, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Black men and boys account for more than 80% of suicides among black Americans, according to the CDC, while rates of death by suicide among black men have increased 25% in the past 2 decades. Starting the conversation that stem the tide can begin in the barber's chair, Lewis said. This is rooted in building community-based advocates who can become active leaders, help to reduce the stigma in the black community around discussing mental health, and to navigate generational trauma, Lewis said. When the conversation is about advocates, you're talking about real people who help these people navigate their problems, he continued. This model is how we're going to get out in front of the curve. The barbershop was formative for Rice growing up, and he said remains an important refuge for black men and youth navigating their own struggles. The barbershop is somewhere we can grow and where we can understand how to be men, to be ourselves, to authentically be ourselves, to not be judged, to open up and to have those conversations with our barbers, because we know how pivotal the barbershops and salons in our communities have been, Rice said. For me, the barbershop has helped me become a better person, a better advocate, and most of all, a better man. This page 12 piece was titled Cutting Through the Stigma, Black Barbers Bring Mental Health Care to the Styling Chair, and it was written by Daryl Smith of the Sacramento Bee.
Our next front page article is Senate Rejects Governor's Rules for Skill Games. The vote moves back to Youngkin, written by David Ress of the Times-Dispatch. The state Senate on Wednesday rejected Governor Glenn Youngkin's amendments that would toughen state oversight when Virginia legalizes skill games. The 34 votes against Youngkin's proposals versus 6 supporting them move the measure back to the governor, who has the power to veto the measure. If he does, there is no opportunity to override it. With the bill now headed back to Youngkin's desk, we Youngkin's proposals versus 6 supporting them move the measure back to the governor, who has the power to veto the measure. If he does, there is no opportunity to override it. With the bill now headed back to Youngkin's desk, we hope that he reconsiders the future of the tens of thousands of small businesses struggling to make ends meet here in his own commonwealth, said Rich Kelly, president of the Virginia Merchants and Amusement Coalition, a group of stores that have lobbied for legalization. Youngkin had no immediate comment on the Senate vote. Press Secretary Christian Martinez said, Skill games are the slot machine-like electronic gaming devices that the General Assembly banned in 2020. A Greensville County judge barred the state from enforcing the ban, but the Virginia Supreme Court reinstated the ban last year. Convenience stores, restaurants, and truck stops hard hit by the pandemic say they have relied on income from the skill games to stay in business. Hundreds of convenience stores protesting the governor's amendments this week declined to sell lottery tickets on Monday and closed their doors for one of their busiest hours on Tuesday. Zahid Hussein, owner of the Halifax Exxon on US 301 in South Richmond, said the machines are a lifeline for small businesses and that their revenue remains critical. We survived the time of COVID because of these games, Hussein said of the convenience stores that feature the machines. Now, without the revenue they provide, we are not able to keep the doors open, he said. It is really hard for us. Youngkin's amendment would have boosted taxes on the machines, dramatically raising the licensing fees stores and truck stops pay, and cut the number of machines they can install. The governor also proposed strict geographic limitations that would bar the machines within 35 miles of other gaming sites such as casinos, Rosie's Gaming Emporiums, or horse tracks. The governor also wanted to prevent the machines from being used within 2,500 feet of a school, a house of worship, or a daycare center. Hussein of Halifax Exxon said that the combined restrictions would bar skill games from almost 90% of Virginia. Senator Aaron Roos, Democrat from Virginia Beach, who sponsored the legislation, has called Youngkin's proposed amendments a slap in the face to thousands of Virginia small businesses. Roos's Senate Bill 212 was a compromise between what the Senate approved and stricter oversight in the version of the law that came out of the House of Delegates. In its final version, the measure had tightened some regulation from what the skill game promoters had wanted, but it would still cut the number of skill games in Virginia convenience stores, restaurants, and truck stops from the 80,000 that had been installed after the court order blocking enforcement of the 2020 ban. This was according to Delegate Terry Gilgore, Republican from Scott. Skill game revenue would be taxed at 25%, up from the Senate's 15%, but less than the 30% that the House bill proposed. Youngkin's amendment would have increased the taxes to 35%. His amendments would also have given localities authority to ban the games. He also proposed that the games have to pay out at least 80% of the money people wager, and that cities and counties can adopt ordinances or hold a referendum on banning the machines. The maximum payout would be capped at $500. Youngkin's amendments would have boosted the license fee for stores and truck stops from the $250 in the General Assembly bill to $9,000 for a convenience store and $21,000 for a truck stop. Stores would be allowed to host only 3 games instead of the 4 in Roos's bill, while truck stops would be limited to 7 instead of 10. The money hosts get from the machines will not be allowed to exceed 20% of their total gross revenue. The lottery, rather than the Alcoholic Beverage Control Authority, would be responsible for regulating skill games, and there would be a centralized monitoring system tracking what the games take in, what they pay out, and what taxes are due. The games promoters had opposed that when some legislators unsuccessfully proposed the idea during the session. Front page piece, Senate rejects governor's rules for skill games. Vote moves measure back to Youngkin, was written by David Ress of the Times-Dispatch.
And continuing on page one, daughter still thrives at home. Porter stayed in Richmond when dad left VCU. All roads, and that's spelled R-H-O-A-D-E-S, lead home to where the heart is. Born in Richmond and ingrained in the city's lacrosse community. St. Catherine's School senior attacker Porter Rhodes, the daughter of former Virginia Commonwealth University men's basketball coach and current Penn State hoops coach Mike Rhodes, had a decision to make last spring when her dad took the job in Happy Valley and moved back to his home state. Though she'd lived in Houston for a few years while Mike coached at Rice University, Porter was raised by Richmond. Mike was the head coach at Randolph-Macon College for 10 seasons before spending 5 years as a Rams assistant prior to taking the head job with the Owls. She encouraged her dad to follow his heart if it led him to Happy Valley, but she knew she wasn't ready to make the move herself just yet. "From the get-go, I think he knew that I really wanted to stay," Porter said. "Fortunately, we were able to make that work. It was really hard for me at first because me and my dad are so close, but this time and space has shown me how strong our connection is. Before my dad took the Penn State job, people's parents were texting my mom saying that I could stay in their guest house or their guest rooms for the year. That shows that they're so loving, some of my best friends." Though she appreciated the offers, Porter didn't end up in anyone's guest house. She stayed behind with her mother, Jody, for her senior year to finish high school with an assortment of close friends, many of whom she's forged bonds with through the sport she loves. Her St. Catherine's team has 11 seniors, among them Porter's close friend, Peyton Sutton, a Florida Southern recruit. "Those girls are my sisters," she said. "All my best memories are with them. Basketball runs in the family, and it was among the sports Porter dabbled in during her youth, in addition to soccer, field hockey, swimming, softball, and gymnastics. But lacrosse became hers, the thing that set her aside from the rest of the family and her rich athletic lineage. Her older brother, Logan, of Mills Godwin, is a sophomore defensive back on Colgate. He's a sophomore defensive back on Colgate University's football team, and her younger brother, Chase, is a multi-sport athlete. Porter picked up lacrosse in second grade and honed her craft in Richmond's club scene over the years. It was my thing. Nobody in my family had played it. I realized that if I worked really hard, I could be really good at this, said Porter, a team captain and shifty goal scorer who netted 27 goals and dished out 14 assists in her junior season. Porter, who used to watch film with her dad on a regular basis, said basketball and lacrosse have plenty of schematic overlap, so she sees the game through the eyes of a coach. Especially during the pandemic, Porter loved to break down VCU film with her dad. Amid quarantine, Porter would bike to Godwin's field and train with VCU lacrosse player Carrie-Anne McTavish. She really boosted my confidence and also taught me how to really play, Porter said of McTavish, who led the Rams with 32 points in her senior year. Chief among her lacrosse mentors have been Lotus Lacrosse Academy director Jess Rudloff, Brooke Ireland, a former Virginia Tech player and coach, who also spent time coaching at Collegiate and the College of William and Mary, and Trish Alexander of Ultimate Lacrosse. Ireland, who has deep local roots, has become a cornerstone of Porter's lacrosse and personal upbringing. She's basically an aunt to me, Porter said. When my dad moved, I had some internal battles. She really helped me. Last spring was a whirlwind for the Rhodes family amid widespread speculation regarding Mike's future. Though Porter's supposed to refrain from it, she would sometimes look up her dad's name on X, Twitter at the time, after games and during the coaching transition. I kept seeing all this stuff, people tracking planes, know our address. It's creepy, it's weird, but it's funny because I knew deep down inside my dad's living life too. He needs to do amazing things too, she said. When he sat us down and had the conversation with us, I was like, you can't not take this job. It's amazing. Upon visiting Penn State, Porter thought it was perfect for her dad, and she began building relationships with the administration of Nittany Lions Athletics. But for me personally, I was nervous. I didn't really want to move for my senior year. I really wanted to finish everything out, she said. So she relayed her apprehension to her mother, who in turn talked to Mike. Then the family decided Porter would stay behind for her senior year. Plenty of commutes to Happy Valley have followed, but while evaluating her own college destination, Porter, who doesn't love training in the heat, knew she wanted to play her college lacrosse up north. Then, as she and Jody walked around the campus after a Nittany Lions game, they happened across a certain fatefully named campus thoroughfare, Porter Road. And now Porter is committed to play at Penn State, where her dad's office overlooks the practice field. All roads lead home, to where the heart is, after all. The first time we pulled up to it, I was like, it's meant to be, said Porter, relaying an anecdote of crying in Publix after Pilates class when she received the offer call from PSU coach Missy Doherty. Going from St. Catharines to Penn State will be really cool because of how close our team is now. Like her dad, Porter will be off to chase new horizons in Pennsylvania soon, but her hometown will always be with her wherever life's roads lead. It's become a place of comfort. My parents know I'll probably come back. This is my home, she said. I also know I'm going to go meet more best friends and have a new home. But I will find myself in Richmond the majority of my time when I can. This front page article, Daughter Still Thrives at Home, was written by Zach Joachim of the Richmond Times-Dispatch.